The Church of God, the Eternal presents the 32nd message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, August 29th, 2026.
We're going to pick up on this series of the books of Samuel. And if you'll recall now, this is already the 32nd message. We finished last time the very last chapter of the book of 1 Samuel, moved right into chapter 1 of 2 Samuel because there is really no break there. We saw in chapter 31 the sad demise of King Saul and his son Jonathan, and this major battle with the Philistines, in which certainly then God allowed the Philistines to have the upper hand and decimated the Israelite army. We saw then the account of the messenger that came and found David in Ziklag, where he and his men are still residing in the Philistine domicile. With the news, we read that whole storyline. Remember what we saw is that David continues to defy normal expectations of the way people would think you would behave. Well, number one, by mourning King Saul, even though Saul had made himself an absolute utter enemy to David. And yet, David shows incredible remorse for the death of Saul and, of course, his son Jonathan, who was his best friend. And goes further by punishing those who would show disrespect to King Saul, even in death. So now that we're that got us through verse 16 of 2 Samuel chapter 1, we're going to pick up in verse 17, but I thought I'd do a quick recap just now that we're into 2 Samuel. From the very first message of this series, where I kind of gave you an overview of the layout of the books, 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings, and I just kind of want to repeat that to put it fresh in your memory. Recall that the 1st and 2nd Samuel tell the story of the very last judge. It's really an extension of the book of Judges. And of course, the last judge before the first king was the prophet Samuel himself, for which the book is named. And so 1 Samuel tells the story of Samuel himself, and then mostly King Saul, but then David as his rise from youth up through now this very period that we're talking about, leading into his being put by God on the throne of Israel. So that takes us through basically the first book. 2 Samuel is going to see through the majority of the rest of the life of David and all of his exploits, good and bad. Then, really, the storyline is continued in the books of 1 Kings and 2 Kings. And really, as I told you way back at the beginning, those four books really make a volume. So the storyline is 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings. Together, they're more appropriately called the books of the kings. All right. Now, I'm not making a commitment. I only planned and designed because my intent of this series is to cover the details of the life of David, which is encapsulated mostly in 1 and 2 Samuel. Now, the death of David is in 1 Kings, so I'll probably have to go over there. I'm not making a commitment that I want to carry this series through 1 and 2 Kings, but I'll keep that door open, at least for the future. Those books continue to tell the story of the life of King Solomon, and then after Solomon's death, the divide of the kingdom between his son Rehoboam and the northern kingdom under Jeroboam, and then all of the kings of Israel and of Judah after that, up until the Assyrian captivity and the Babylonian captivity. All right, so that's what those four books really give you comprehensively from beginning to the end. And it is a fabulous story. There's lessons through all of it. So I'm not saying that I won't necessarily continue to cover it. But as I've iterated, the lessons of the life of David, I think, are the most significant of any involved in it. Who wrote the book of 2 Samuel? As you know, we already covered the death of Samuel in 1 Samuel. And so it's attributed that the prophet Samuel himself wrote the first part of it up until his death, but obviously he didn't write anything after his death. So the best information we have, and there is no indication of an official author of these books. 1 Chronicles 29:29, which I had referenced to you long ago, is our best hint. Right at the end of 1 Chronicles chapter 29, at the very end, that's at the very end of the book, and it says there that the records of these are the records of Samuel the seer, Nathan the prophet, and Gad the seer. So a lot of the commentators believe that very likely that the books of 1 and 2 Samuel were actually penned by God's inspiration through Samuel and through Nathan the prophet and through Gad the seer, who we've talked about in the past, so I won't spend time repeating that. All right, we're ready to go forward. 2 Samuel 1, now picking up the storyline in verse 17. Now, David gets this horrible news, the death of Saul and Jonathan on the battlefield, the rout of the Israelite army. And so he not only mourns, but now, because remember, David is a poet and a musician. And so he pours his mourning for the death of Saul and Jonathan into this dirge, if you will. And that's what now we read in verse 17. David lamented with this lamentation. So there's something specific that follows here. David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan, his son, verse 18. And he bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. And that's very confusing. What? What does that have to do with anything? I thought we were talking about him writing a musical ode to Saul and David. And now we're talking about, there's commentators who said, well, because the Philistines, you see, defeated the army of Israel very much with their archers, then David's response was to say that the Israelites need to learn, you know, the way of the bow and become consummate archers like the Philistines if we're going to win in future battles. But that doesn't fit the context of what's going on here. This word use of is not there. If you're looking at the King James like I use, it's in italics. It's very likely a mistranslation. Some commentators argue, you know, that it's talking about the bow as a weapon, but most interpret it that this should say the song of the bow. Now that makes perfect sense. And it actually fits with the Hebrew. That that David laments himself and then writes this lamentation and then teaches it to the people. What's he going to teach them? He teaches them this new song that he wrote in honor of Saul and Jonathan, entitled The Song of the Bow, as a lamentation over their death, and commands all of the people of the tribe of Judah to learn this new song as David wrote it. And so then what follows beginning in verse 19 literally is the text from this dirge. And so we began to, oh, by the way, as we read in verse 18, it says, it's written in the book of Jasher. I've referenced this before. Where's the book of Jasher? Wouldn't it be nice to have it? We don't have it. It was a historical book that existed in the day that the writer under God's inspiration was putting this book together, whether it was Nathan or Gad, but it doesn't exist today, which means it didn't survive and God didn't choose to bring it down. So we don't have the book of Jasher, but it was real and existed at the time. And so it was used as a reference source. Okay. Verse 19, let's actually read this song that David wrote. It begins, "The beauty of Israel is slain upon the high places." Now, this isn't like the high places that we read about, the pagan high places, their Baal worship and all of that. It's literally referring to a high mountain, a place that is high as opposed to low in geography. And in this case, as you're going to find out very quickly, it's talking about Mount Gilboa, which was the very site where Saul and Jonathan were slain by the Philistines on that particular high place. "The beauty of Israel is slain upon the high places. How are the mighty fallen?" You're going to see this is a phrase now that's repeated two more times in the lyric. Verse 20, tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ascalon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. Gath, you already know, is one of the major cities, headquarters in the land of the Philistines, Ascalon as well. And so this is, now the Philistines knew it, and David knew that they knew it. And they were absolutely celebrating the death of Saul. And not just Jonathan, but two others of the sons of Saul. And we already read the account of them taking the body of Saul and his sons and literally pinning them up on the walls of the nearby city and taking the head of Saul and probably transporting it, to the western portion of their domain. So the Philistines knew, David knew they knew, but in lyric fashion, he's writing about the desire in his heart that the enemies would not have the knowledge from which they would celebrate the death. Verse 21, you mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, neither let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away, the shield of Saul as though he had not been anointed with oil. The sentiment there is, you know, he was anointed by God as the king over Israel, which should have, ideally, provided him some supernatural defense, help, aid, shield. And yet, with his ignominious death, he just seemed to be some guy subject to time and chance in the world. And certainly the degradation that was showed to him and his family after their death on the battlefield. And so David, in poetic form, is lamenting that Saul ultimately was treated as if he wasn't the anointed. What happened to him is if he didn't have God's favor. Now, you and I know he lost God's favor. So God permitted, by removing his special protection and help from Saul, and permitted now the enemies of Israel to prevail. And not only to kill the king and three of his sons, but to slaughter many of Israel's soldiers in this great conflict. Verse 22, from the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back. So now he turns to speak not about directly the lamentation about the death of Saul and Jonathan, but now he starts to look back on the exploits in the early days of King Saul and of Jonathan prior. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. They had been mighty warriors. They had been incredibly effective leading the armies of Israel against all enemies, and especially the Philistines, in past decades. And that's what David now is highlighting in this ode. Verse 23, Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death, they were not divided. Isn't it interesting? So David is not focusing on the negative. He's intentionally choosing to accentuate the positive aspects of the life of King Saul. He's not bearing the failings of Saul, which were many. But for this particular, and if you want to call this a national, I'm not going to say it's a national anthem as if it became the national song played for the nation of Israel, but it became a national song. David wrote this for the intention, as we're going to see, that it would be sung, it would be, in fact, memorized, and it would continue to be something that would laud the life of Saul and Jonathan in particular. And so David is emphasizing the positive about the early years of Saul, back before he lost God's favor, when he was a mighty king and a general in the service of God for the betterment of Israel. And that's what he's choosing to emphasize here. Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives. In their death, they were not divided. He emphasizes the fact that they died together on the battlefield. They were, in spite of the fact that Jonathan had a very different orientation than his father did. His father had turned very, very dark and gotten the witch of Endor, so he'd really turned himself over to this occult influence. Jonathan didn't do that. And yet, Jonathan showed the respect of the office that his father held and remained at his side. And so that was a testament to him. And so they were not divided. They were certainly together. In their death, they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. That was the history of their earlier years. Verse 24, you daughters of Israel weep over Saul. He didn't say, yay, yay, ding dong, the witch is dead, you know, or the king who tormented me is dead. Yay, let's celebrate. He was sincere in saying, this is a time of mourning. Ye daughters of Israel weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet, with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel. David is highlighting the fact that the early years of Saul, Israel was really blessed as a nation under his guidance. When he had God's favor, he became an incredible blessing to the entire nation as God used him powerfully to defend the nation and to enrich them against their enemies around. Verse 25, how are the mighty fallen? The second time again that phrase is repeated. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? Oh, and now he turns with a special lamentation for Jonathan himself. Oh, Jonathan, thou was slain in thine high places. Again, not pagan high places, speaking about one. So physically, of course, because it was on the mountain of Gilboa, it was a high place geographically where he and Saul died. I think it's very likely you can read into this also a poetic reference to the fact that Jonathan died at the height of his age, his strength, for his family, and for everything. I mean, he was at the pinnacle of his own personal success, even though he was under the guidance and the authority of his father, who was descending down more and more. But Jonathan had set an incredible example. Oh, Jonathan, thou wast slain in thy high places. Verse 26, I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. He's now emphasizing the blessing that Jonathan had been to David personally because of defending him and helping him. Even when Jonathan's father was trying to kill him, Jonathan was clandestinely helping him and helping save him from that kind of wrath and vindication. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. And I'll say again, no, this doesn't say they weren't, you know, homosexual lovers, which is, you know, people want to read nonsense and perversion and everything that they read these days to make them feel better about their own perversions. I hope none of you have that in your mind at all. This is David's now words to describe the importance about the closeness that he felt in kinship with Jonathan as his best friend, one that he absolutely trusted with his life. And that was proven over many occurrences. He said, thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. Isn't the love of Jesus Christ greater than the love of sexual love between a man and a woman? Yes, it is. Do you feel that way? I hope so. We are talking about a love which is, and what is love? Outgoing concern for someone else. It's the willing to show outward consideration for someone else, even at your own expense. To be loyal, to be faithful, to support them, especially in their greatest time of need. That's what real love is. And what David is saying here is that's what Jonathan provided for him in his time of greatest vulnerability, when he was at greatest risk, and Jonathan was the one who came to his rescue. He was a friend indeed. The other side I would tell, from David's perspective, I wonder how much he ever had a closeness with women. Oh, he had a whole bunch of wives. We're going to soon find out about how many wives he had. At this point in the storyline, he's only had three. Michael, the daughter of Saul, was his first wife, his true wife, because she's still alive. Michael's going to come back on the scene in a few chapters as well. In the interim, while he's been on the run for 8 to 10 years, he's married two other women. Okay, but so from David's standpoint, he's writing this ode, this lamentation, this emotional outpouring concerning how he feels now about his relationship with Jonathan, and he says it surpasses the love of women. Well, I would argue that David probably never had a true close relationship with, he never really had it with Michal, his first wife. He didn't have the opportunity. He had to go on the run. And now you're talking about second and third wives who in God's eyes aren't real wives. So I would tell you there's ample reason for David not to feel like anything he experienced in marriage, quote unquote, compared to the closeness, the oneness, and the faithful confidence that he had in Jonathan. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women. And then the last phrase of the lamentation, verse 27, how art the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished? A third recitation of the phrase, how are the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished? So wouldn't it be great to have the song, the actual music that David wrote to go with this? And so it wasn't just a poem that was recited, it was a song that was sung. And David wanted it taught, and he wanted people to know it, and he wanted them to repeat it because he wanted to remember that piece of history concerning the positive aspects of the life of both Saul and Jonathan. So it had to be taught specifically to the people of Judah, because that's where David is. He has no influence right now over all of the tribes in the north, as we're getting ready to find out. So really, this was something that began to be taught to the people, the Israelites, whom he had close association with, which would be the ones of the tribe of Judah in the south. All right, now we move on to chapter 2, 2 Samuel 2 now, and verse 1. Here we're going to find that, lo and behold, David is going to ask for God's advice. Now, he did this, thankfully, previously when he asked God if he should go after the Amalekites who raided his city and took all their families and their wealth away. You know, he started a good turn by beginning to ask for God's input on what he should do and where he should go. It came to pass, verse 1, after this, that David inquired of the Eternal, saying, shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah? Remember, he's still in the land of the Philistines, where he's lived for more than a year and a half. But now Saul's dead. And in David's mind, he's thinking, I think this is a turning point, and I should go back to my homeland. But instead of presuming it and just taking off on his own, he actually asks God, shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah? And the Eternal said to him, we're presuming that he's asking through the high priest, Abiathar, who is still with him, not just on his own. The Eternal said unto him, go up. And David said, whither shall I go up? So not just, okay, go wherever you want to. David asked further, all right, I'm supposed to go into the land of Judah, but where specifically? He wanted to know where God wanted him. Whither shall I go up? And God said, unto Hebron. So now David has specific marching orders from God. David remembers that he had been anointed by the hands of the prophet Samuel to become king. This is all about the will of God. David is not presuming to do things his own way or to take matters into his own hands. He is now recognizing that what is before him is according to the inspiration and the guidance of an invisible God. He believes in that God, he respects that God, and he's showing evidence that he wants to fulfill that role, not some whim of his own. God tells him, yes, go into Judah, go specifically to the city of Hebron. Verse 2, so David went up hither, and his two wives also, Ahinoam the Jezreelite, and Abigail, Nabal's wife, the Carmelite, and his men that were with him, did David bring up even every man and his household. So how many people was this? Because remember, what was the size of his army? 600 fighting men. Now, if they all had, or most of them had wives, and an average number of children for the day. What was the size of this entourage? David, 600 warriors, wives and children. It's very likely that this is an entourage of 2,000 bodies. And they're all going to pick up and move out of the land of the Philistines back into the area of Judah. Now, he was wandering in the deserts of Judah for 8 to 10 years. So he's kind of going back to the area where he was before, only now without an enemy who's actually in the form of King Saul trying to kill him. Okay, what do we know about this city of Hebron? Hebron was originally, it's a historic city that was originally given by God to the Levites, and more specifically to the sons of Aaron, the priests. Now, how did that come about? I'm not going to go back and give you that history, but just synoptically to understand the significance of the city of Hebron. Remember, when God first divided the promised land to the children of Israel under Joshua, all right, how many divisions were there? 12, right? 12 tribes? Well, there were really 13 tribes. Why? Because Joseph, one of the 12 sons of Jacob, received a double portion. Remember, his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, by God's decree, were counted as if they were sons, not grandsons of Joseph or of Jacob. All right? So you really had, you had 12 sons, but of Joseph, his two sons were counted. So you really had 13 for God to divide. How many of all the promised land that God intended to give to the Israelites across the Jordan River, how many parcels was it divided in? 12. But wait a minute, there's 13. Because the Levites weren't given land. Okay, so all of the other tribes and the half-tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh were all given 1/12 of the promised land. What about the Levites? The Levites were the tithe of the nation. God claimed them literally as a tithe of the people and set them aside to do the religious work of the entire nation. All right? So they're, according to the sacrificial system, there needed to be the offerings, the holy day meetings, and all these things through the whole nation, right? Now they would come up where the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant were at given times in the year. But the whole rest of the year, they needed a local priesthood. So in God's plan, what did he do? He gave the Levites, they didn't get property like the other tribes did, but they did get cities. So God pinpointed specific cities that were literally spread out through all the 12 tribes so that all of the tribes would have a presence of Levites to do the religious work in their jurisdiction. And so God gave the Levites control over certain cities where they and their families lived, and they did their work. They weren't primarily farmers or ranchers. They focused their attention on the religious work to serve all of the rest of the Israelites. So they got cities, not big expanses of lands that had to be taken care of and worked. All right. So Hebron was one of those cities given to the Levites in particular in the tribal territory of Judah. Furthermore, Hebron just wasn't given to the Levites. It was specifically allocated to Aaron's family of the priests. So you had a whole tribe of Levi. But Aaron was only one son out of many sons that came from the patriarch Levi. And only Aaron and his sons God appointed to be the priests to do the work of the tabernacle and ultimately the temple. So this city of Hebron not only was allocated to the Levites, more specifically, it was allocated to the descendants of Aaron out of that tribe. One other significance, not only that, Hebron was also appointed as one of the cities of refuge. And I'm definitely not going in to explain all of that. But very quickly, Joshua 21, verse 13, just as a single point of reference to confirm what I'm telling you. Joshua 21, 13 says, "Thus they gave to the children of Aaron, the priest," not just the Levites in general, but the family of Aaron, "Hebron with her suburbs to be a city of refuge for the slayer." So it was a city of refuge, and if you understand God's ingenious judicial system that he gave in ancient Israel, they didn't have prisons. There was no prison system where you locked away people for life. If you committed a crime that was worthy of death, a capital crime, you got stoned to death. All right? Now, what if it wasn't murder? What if it was a killing or a death that happened and it wasn't clear whether it was murder, meaning intentional, or whether it was an accident, or whether it was manslaughter, meaning a negligent circumstance. Somebody is responsible for the death of another. They didn't mean it, though. It wasn't premeditated. God provided this whole system that someone who became responsible for the death of someone else could flee to one of these cities of refuge that were spread out through all the tribes of Israel. Hebron happened to be one of those cities of refuge. And that just meant that until the judges literally figured out the facts of the case, all right, that killer could be spared as long as they stayed within the walls of the city of refuge. All right? Now, if it was manslaughter, if it wasn't murder, if they were guilty of the death of someone, but it was accidental, it was unintentional, they could live without fear of being killed, either by the judges or by the family. Because isn't this what happens? The family of the one who's wrongfully died, they want vengeance. All right, God recognized the carnal nature of these people. And according to the first covenant, he wasn't trying to subjugate that the way he is in us. All right. So literally, if the family of someone who is responsible for the death of their relative could catch up to them and kill them, they could take their vengeance as long as they didn't make it to the city of refuge. Once they got inside the city of refuge, that family could not touch them, or else they would be guilty of a capital crime themselves. And as long as that killer stayed in the city of refuge. So that was like a prison, if you will. It's like house arrest. You had the freedom to live and to move around the city, but if you went outside that city, the grieving family had a right to take their vengeance on you. So that was God's system, all appointed. You can read that in the law. Okay, so it took into consideration in wisdom carnal human nature and provided a way to manage it. Now, if it turns out that person was convicted by the judges of murder, they couldn't be saved by being in a city of refuge. They would have been hauled out and stoned to death. But anyway, that's just to give you that background. So the city of Hebron in Judah happened to be not only the city of the Levites, the city in particular controlled by the descendants of Aaron the priests, but also it was a city of refuge. Now the question is, how much of this in the days of David and Saul were they even still doing? And very likely not much. Mr. Cole used to say it's very likely the Israelites ever really followed all of these laws that God gave them for very long. And so I'm not even sure that it was even being used as God intended it as a true city of refuge for these legal cases. But however, Hebron was set aside for that purpose in God's plan. So this is where God tells David to go, to this very key city in the tribe of Judah to make his headquarters. All right, back to 2 Samuel 2, verse 4. What happens when he and his men, oh, and by the way, because in verse 3 we saw it says they dwelt in the cities of Hebron, plural. Well, city, isn't in Hebron just one city? Yeah. So what it really means is Hebron and surrounding villages, meaning even as we read in Joshua 21, Hebron with its suburbs its outer areas that were kind of associated with the city in general. All right. So what happens when David gets there? Probably an entourage. I'm guessing it could have been 2,000 people with all their families. Now they move into this district. Verse 4, and the men of Judah came and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. This is the first time now where David literally is moving into the role of authority in the capacity of a king. Now recall, he had been anointed by Samuel maybe 15 years earlier. We already read the accounts that said that David began to rule when he was 30 years old. So this account right here in Hebron is when he is 30 years old. How old was he when Samuel first showed up at Jesse's doorstep and found David and laid hands upon him with oil? He might have been as young as 15. Remember, he was still out taking care of the sheep in the field. So perhaps 15 years before this event takes place now. And so in God's plan, it took this long, finally, for the fulfillment or a partial fulfillment of that which God had set in motion probably a decade and a half earlier. Now, what did the leaders of the tribe of Judah have in mind? It doesn't say here that they had God in mind. They very likely just thought, hey, David's our guy. I mean, he's from the tribe of Judah. He and his family are from Bethlehem. He's our guy. He's the surviving general now in Israel that has the power, the clout. We're going to back him. So it's probably just a political ploy by these leaders in Judah to say, we're going to elevate David and put him on the throne over our tribe. That's all they had the authority. They didn't have the authority over anything except the tribe of Judah and their precinct. So they're going to lay hands upon him and make him their king. By what authority? None. But did David have the authority of God? Oh, yes, he did. So who was backing this up regardless of what was in the mind of the leaders of the tribe? God absolutely was giving sanction and approval of this action. He had already had David anointed 10 to 15 years earlier. Now you're seeing the fulfillment of it. This is also the first evidence of a literal divide within the greater kingdom of Israel. Up until this time, Saul ruled over all of this. Now, it doesn't mean he had powerful sway in all areas of all tribes, but it was under a singular government under King Saul. This is the first time now with this power vacuum, with Saul being killed, and Jonathan, and the other two sons of Saul, that now people are scrambling and saying, hey, we've got this lack. We need to fill the void here. We need to figure out and get the right people in that we want for our purposes, which is what happens. All right? So the leaders of Judah say, David's our guy. Let's go ahead and anoint him. Let's go do this coronation and make him king over Judah as the stronghold now in the nation. This is the first time we see a divide because we're getting ready to get to the other side. So now you've got the trappings, everything setting up for a civil war. No longer unified under one king. Now you're going to have a divided kingdom for the first time. So the men of Judah came. There they anointed David king over the house of Judah. And they told David, saying that the men of Jabesh-Gilead were they that buried Saul. Why is this important? So after, in essence, coronating David as king over Judah, these leaders of Judah wanted David to know that the leaders of Jabesh-Gilead were the ones who showed special honor and respect for Saul. And we read that story already. They sneaked across the Jordan. Remember, where's Jabesh? That's on the east side of the Jordan River, in that whole area of Gilead. There was a half tribe of Manasseh and those of Gad that have their tribal lands, all right? Now, the interesting thing about it is the people of Jabesh are actually loyal to Saul. and his house, not to David and Judah. But the leaders of Judah wanted David to know, because they figured out, I think these leaders of the Jewish nation figured out, that David cared about respect for the office of king, even if Saul wasn't really their favorite. And they're pointing out to David, you're making us learn this poem to sing in honor of Saul and Jonathan. You probably also want to know that the men of Jabesh-Gilead are the ones who showed the greatest respect at risk to their lives by sneaking in the middle of the night across the Jordan River, taking down the bodies of Saul and his sons, and taking them back and burying them properly in their homeland on the east side of the Jordan. They told David, saying, the men of Jabesh-Gilead were they that buried Saul. And David sent messengers unto the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said unto them, blessed be you of the Eternal, that you have showed this kindness unto your Lord, even unto Saul, and have buried him. So David, in his first act, or at least the first recorded act in this capacity as king over the tribe of Judah, he sends emissaries to give thanks, special thanks to these men of Jabesh who put their own lives at risk to show honor to Saul and to Jonathan. Verse 6, and now, David says, the Eternal show kindness and truth unto you, and I also will requite you this kindness because you have done this thing. Therefore now let your hands be strengthened. So he's pronouncing a blessing upon these people on the east side of the Jordan River. Let your hands be strengthened. Be you valiant, for your master Saul is dead, and also the house of Judah have anointed me king over them. What's the politics going on here? With the death of the king, everybody's going to be on edge. What's going to happen? There's a power vacuum. Who's going to end up rising to the top? Where are we going to be in this? Is this going to turn out good for us or bad for us or whatever? These people on the east side of the river were favorable. They were strong supporters of Saul. Remember, when we went back and rehearsed that, because in his early days, when he had God's favor, he had come to their rescue against the barbarians to their east and saved their lives. So they had this perpetual respect and honor for Saul and his family. All right, there was the allegiance. Now, David had become the enemy of Saul. So what would have been the natural relationship between these people of Jabesh-Gilead and David? They would have been enemies. If David had been the enemy of Saul and they were the friends of Saul and supporters, they would have naturally looked at David with a jaundiced eye. What is David doing here, which is incredibly wise and prudent? He is reaching out and showing respect and honor to them because of the way that they treated the dead bodies of Saul, showing his support for the respect of Saul for the office of kingship which he held, even if he himself had been the victim of Saul's wrath. He's putting all of that aside, and he's saying, what you did was phenomenal, and asking God to pronounce a blessing upon them for the way that they treated it. He's trying to take, in essence, the division or the potential tension out of the relationship with these important Israelites on the east side of the Jordan River. It's an incredibly wise move diplomatically that he is making by doing this. So he's solidifying good rapport with key Israelites on the east side of Jordan, who had been the natural and were still the natural allies of the house of Saul. All right, which is going to lead us now right into verse 8. Now we're going to see the other side of the divided kingdom. If David was elevated by the leaders of Judah over the southern part of the nation, what about the northern part? Verse 8. But Abner, the son of Ner, captain of Saul's host, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim, verse 9, and made him king over Gilead and over the Asherites and over Jezreel and over Ephraim and over Benjamin and over all Israel. Okay, there's a lot to unpack here. What's going on? Who's taking the lead here now to try and fill the power vacuum? Abner. Remember who Abner was? He was the chief general under King Saul. Furthermore, remember, it's Abner, son of Ner. Who was Ner? Ner was the brother of Kish. Well, who's that? That is Saul's father. In other words, so who was Abner? Remember, Abner was the first cousin of King Saul. So they were family, they were blood. But Abner had become key now as the military general that Saul trusted and leaned upon, and that had been the case for decades. So what is true here? Saul and Jonathan are dead, and the next two sons, there's only one son of Saul left alive. This youngest son named Ishbosheth. And apparently he was just kind of the weak link, if you will. Yeah, so he was the son of Saul, but he wasn't really powerful in his own personality. He wasn't the one asserting, who's pulling the strings here and making things happen? It's Abner. This is your military general now filling the void, and he's in essence ruling. Now, he's a cousin of Saul, but he's not the son of Saul, and while there's a son of Saul left, he needs to show respect. So what is Abner trying to do? He's trying to coalesce a new government that all the tribes of Israel will respect. So in essence, what he's doing is forcing the last son of Saul, Ishbosheth, forward. Here's your new king. He's the son of Saul. Pat him on the head, put him in his corner, and then let Abner actually run everything. The power behind the throne. Abner's the one pulling the strings, all right? He's the one who's making all of this happen. Now, what does he do in his wisdom? And he was a wise. I mean, Abner was a fierce warrior, and he was shrewd, and he was wise. So from the standpoint of the carnal mind, Abner was top-notch. I will stop and ask you again, where is God? Is Abner seeking God? I mean, come on. He's a Benjamite, he's an Israelite, like all the rest of them. Is he going and seeking God to know what God wants to happen? Well, the problem was Saul is the one that had all the priests killed. Remember that? He had all of those dozens of priests killed, and the only one that escaped was Abiathar, who ran immediately to David and has been now his personal priest through all these years. So, one, Abner's got nobody to turn to because the priests are all dead. Or the priests that are alive are not even in that domain anymore. They all had to flee the wrath of Saul. But is Abner even thinking about that? Or is Abner just being a good carnal human being who's taking matters into his own hands and making decisions that based out of his own history, his knowledge, his years of experience, and his wisdom? Yeah, that's exactly what Abner's doing. And from a carnal standpoint, Abner's really good at it. So what's his scheme? What's his solution to the problems of the nation now that there's this huge power vacuum at the top? Well, Abner's in the best position to secure the nation of Israel and to help it go forward. But he needs this last son of Saul as a puppet, as a figurehead, while he runs everything behind the scenes. So he gets Ishbosheth. Now, where are they going to set up? Are they going to set up in the tribe of Benjamin? In Gibeah, which is where the fortress headquarters of Saul was? All of those years, Saul ruled from Gibeah. So that is not what happens. What we read here was that he took Ishbosheth and brought him over to Mahanaim. Made him king over Gilead first on the list. Where is this? Mahanaim is another one of these cities on the east side of the Jordan River, like Jabesh. Jabesh and Mahanaim are probably 15 miles apart, if you can trust the commentators who try and guess about some of these ancient cities that aren't there anymore. So you're talking about the same eastern side of the Jordan. Why the eastern side of the Jordan? Well, do you remember what happened? When Saul and Israel lost that battle of the Philistine, who has taken over the whole valley of Jezreel and all of these towns, these fortified towns, all right through the middle of the swath of Israelite territory? Philistines are there. They didn't come in there win this big battle, and then go back home. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us anything about the Philistines. So we've got this lack of knowledge. God didn't choose to write it. But you can read between the lines and presume that the first thing that Abner's dealing with is this huge presence of Philistines who are now occupying key parts of their nation. So there was a reason Abner needed to immediately fill that power vacuum. That would make sense, even if it's not accounted for in the storyline. So the first thing he needs to do, one, they're not in control of that area, Jezreel, Mount Gilboa. That's all been taken over by the Philistines. So the first thing he has to do is take the remaining son of Saul and flee across the Jordan River to an area of safety. And they basically set up camp in this city of Mahanaim, a safe haven out of the reach of the Philistines. And now, in essence, Abner's going to install this last remaining son of Saul on the throne. Is he really on the throne? Is he really ruling? No. Who's running most of it? The Philistines. So this is like a figurehead, a king in exile, if you will. He's evacuated the last remaining son out of harm's way and installed him as the king. Yeah, big deal. He's not ruling anything, but he's alive. And he is a figurehead, and Abner now is going to try and rally all of these Israelites from all these different tribes together behind this remaining son of Saul. And remember, we've already seen, Saul had the support of these Transjordanians, all of these people on the east side, as we've already seen. So it was a safe place to go because the remaining son of Saul would have a lot of natural support because of being Saul's son. So it was a wise action on the part of Abner. What authority did Abner have to do any of this? None. Zero. He was just a powerful man in the right place at the right time, and he took advantage of it and he seized it. Verse 10, Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel and reigned 2 years. We're going to have to reconcile some problems with this because we've got some contradictions, but let me read the rest of this. But the house of Judah followed David. So here is a depiction now of a divided kingdom, north and south. Verse 11, and the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Okay, so from the time this event happened, Saul dies, God tells David, yes, go back into Judah, set up your headquarters in Hebron. The leaders of Judah lay hands upon him and coronate him as king over Judah. How long was he in that state? 7 years and 6 months. 7 years and 6 months before what? Before David became king over the whole nation. That's what happened. When something changed 7 years and 6 months later, it was that David now was accepted by all of the people of all of the tribes and reunited the kingdom under one king again. That took 7.5 years. But wait a minute. The storyline reads like Abner immediately after Saul's death installed Ishbosheth on the east side of the Jordan as the king over Israel, but it says he only ruled for 2 years. So he ruled 2 years, but David didn't take over the whole nation until 7.5 years later. We got a 5-year gap. How do we reconcile this? What, was there no king in the north? And after Ishbosheth was out of the way, out of the picture, David just dawdled for another 5 years before eventually kind of heading up north, making himself king over the whole thing? No. So the commentators have a real conundrum over this. The best explanation. Most conservative interpreters believe that after Saul's death, the Philistines continued to control much of the northern territory. I think that's the likely explanation, which God didn't choose to account for, But if they came in there with that massive army and had that great victory over Saul and over the Israelites, and if they stayed as occupiers, the question is, how long would it have taken for someone to kick the Philistines out and get back into their domain in the West? So the best explanation, just trying to connect the dots, is that Abner used the remaining army of Israel in the north progressively to fight against these Philistine interlopers. And it took him effectively 5 years to kick them out back into their territory and to regain control of all those tribal lands that had been lost in that one battle under Saul. Bible doesn't say that. But somehow Israel got back in control of all that land they lost. We just don't have God choosing to give us a story of how it happened. But possibly this description of the reign of Ishbosheth versus the reign of David in Hebron is probably our best puzzle piece to connect the dots. So I like that interpretation best. If the recovery process for Abner to gain back control of that lost land took roughly 5 years, only then was Ishbosheth crowned and he reigned for the final 2 years of that whole 7.5 year period. Now that makes perfect sense. He's a king in exile over on the east side of the Jordan while Abner is slowly taking back city after city that the Philistines had taken away from them. So Ishbosheth is, quote, on the throne, but he's not reigning. He's a figurehead only. But the 2 years of the reign of Ishbosheth may have been intended by God to refer to the period of time when Israel under Abner had actually recouped everything they had lost in that final battle. And now there's actually something for Ishbosheth to roll over. That his reign was the final 2 years of this entire 7.5 year period where David is basically cooling his heels in the south and solidifying his support within the tribe of Israel. From Abner's secure base in Gilead on the east side, he gradually fought to reclaim and reconsolidate the northern territories tribe by tribe, region by region, which is why perhaps it's listed in order, Gilead first, then expanding toward the Asherites, Jezreel, Ephraim, Benjamin, etc. Slowly by surely, he conquers back that lost territory. This reconquest, perhaps, and political reassembly is what most commentators estimate took roughly 5 years to accomplish. Only once Abner had regained enough control did he formally install and have Ishbosheth recognized as king over all Israel except for Judah. All right, and that's, so there may be another explanation. If so, I don't know what it is. It's all guesswork, but that's the one that, for me, makes the most sense. We're actually right almost at an hour of time. And this is a good break, because if I go on any further now, it's going to get into a whole storyline. What's going to happen next between verse 12 and beyond is this first major clash between the army under Abner and the army under David. They're going to come together now in the tribe of Benjamin, not far from the original seat of power under Saul in this area called Gibeon, and we're going to have a major battle. So let's stop there. We'll save that for next time.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented the 32nd message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled, A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, August 29th, 2026.
Thank you.